Hello, dear listeners. This is the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am your host, Katerina Stoykova, and my guest today is artist, poet, visionary, culture futurist, Theo Edmonds. Hi, Theo. Welcome to Accents.
It's good to be with you. It's been too many years.
I know. I look at you, and we go way back.
Way back.
We go way back. Yeah. I remember that fateful night, that fateful evening, when you walked in our poetry group meeting at Common Ground,
yeah,
with your white shirt and bright smile and giant heart, and you told us about your art and your upcoming exhibit, and we all fell in love with you and wanted to spend time with you and wanted to learn about you and wanted to create things together, and we did.
Yes, created a lot of things together, didn't we?
Yeah. And, you know, I remember you invited us, everyone from the writers group, to your studio on Manchester.
On Manchester Street, when there was not much else there at the time.
But you called it, you said, this is an up-and-coming area, yeah, and that was 15 years ago. That's one of the reasons I called you visionary. You see things, and you see things well before they materialize. And then we had a bottle of wine amongst us, and we had these sheets of paper in which we visioned, in which we wrote what we wanted to happen for us and for the group. And do you remember what we wrote there?
I remember us all being there, but I don't remember the specifics of it.
I still have those, you know.
Do you really?
I do have them. And I think that you achieved all your dreams.
You know, I'm a big nerd, and so quantum mechanics is something that I very much am into. And when we see these, especially these days when these new James Webb Space Telescope images kind of come across our media feeds, and it's the only time I've seen that I can think of when you just feel like there's this digital collective, whoa, when one of those new images, you know, comes across the feed, you feel everybody for just a second let all their stuff down, and we connect with something that we had forgot we were even part of when one of those new images comes through. And I've often kind of tried, what's going on there, right, when that happens? And psychologists tell us that there's two states. There's the hypnopompic state and the hypnagogic state, when you're going into sleep and when you're waking from sleep. And there's just kind of a nanosecond when you're waking from dreaming. You know you're not dreaming anymore. You know you're not fully awake anymore. And it's a flash of an eye, but it's this really kind of brief liminal space when there's this kind of amazing melancholy, not in a negative way at all, but just there, you feel loss and anticipation in this perfect kind of harmony. And when those images come along, I think there's something that feels like that going through. And what we know now from quantum mechanics is that it's on a subatomic level that there are always existing multiple possibilities in multiple futures. And our observer effect, where we put our attention and intention, creates what we see as possible and valuable. So growing up, you know, queer and neurodiverse in southeastern Kentucky, I think that I learned to hone kind of what that was. Maybe at first it was out of self-protection in some way, but being able to find that vision, pattern recognition, you know, from a lot of different aspects of life, if if it is true, what, and I believe you, what I wrote on that paper has come to be, I think it has to do with this, you know, how I've learned to do storytelling all my life, because storytelling is not just about the past or about the future. Storytelling is about the infinite present, where all those multiple possibilities exist. And so when we talk about multiple possibilities existing, what we know from neuroscience, memory more than anything else guides creativity. And so ancestral past is present in every single combination of ideas, but there's also this storytelling, writing future history in the moment that is happening. And so that's what I love about that. When you say vision, it has to do with these quantum ideas, that they're where we put our intention and intention, the observer effect on a subatomic level guides us toward that, if we can hold it.
That's about you, that what I have noticed over the years that I've known you, you've been fearless about trying new things.
I have been. I've
you've risked. You have taken quite a few risks.
One after the other. Big swings. Yeah.
And I have seen you live different lives practically.
Yeah. I think about this in this way. If we don't understand where the frontiers of our knowledge are, how do you ever know that you are where you are? And if you're not willing to risk things, you're never going to know where those frontiers of your knowledge are. And I've got a friend in Colorado, where I live now, and they say that they're an entrepreneur and innovator. They say, if you're standing with one foot over the frontier of your knowledge and one foot behind it, you may want to consider how much space you're taking up.
Can you repeat that?
That if you're standing with just one foot over the frontier of where your frontier of knowledge is, if it's just one foot is stepped over, you may want to consider how much space you're taking up on the other side. And it's kind of these, like, you know, these times when I think there's knowing where your frontier of your knowledge is. There's the stepping across. But it's that second foot, pulling it.
The back tier.
Yes. That's where, and you know, when you're in that kind of, that motion, when one foot's in a new pathway, the other one's still firmly planted in the old. Just from a physics standpoint, that's when you're at your shakiest. You can be blown down by the smallest gust of wind at that moment. And so momentum is important, but I think even more important than momentum and just taking risk is, am I becoming wise for the risk I've taken? There was a time in my life when that was clearly not the case, but more and more over the last many years of my life, I like to think that the risks are about becoming wise more than they are about anything else.
But one thing that over the years I have seen over and over is the trust and the faith. I'm going to say the word resignation, that I have no other choice. I got to be creative. I got to be myself. I got to live the way I live.
Yes.
And you have walked the walk.
I've fallen in the holes while walking the walk too. But I keep getting back up.
What does it take to get back up?
Imagination. We like to say it, there's courage, and I think that is part of it. And maybe it's even courageous imagination. But to get back up, especially after you not only fall, but you fall hard and maybe even get kicked a time or two while you're down there, and that's certainly happened to me. To get back up is a radical act of courageous imagination. To get back up after you have taken that fall requires you to envision a reason beyond what you knew before then. Just get back up and try again.
So there is a Bulgarian poet, Konstantin Pavlov, and I'm going to just translate on the fly what I remember. Dying is easy. Resurrecting is what is difficult.
Ooh, come through. Yeah. I'd say resurrecting and composting, I would add to that. What does it take to make transitions in life a lot, whether personally, at a systems level and so forth? And I think the biggest fallacy in making these transitions to your quote you just gave around resurrection, we've got all, especially in the U.S., we've got all these systems set up to manage the process of moving from this phase to that phase. We don't have anything that's really set up to say, who am I? How does my identity stay the same, change, as I transition from this phase to this phase, along with all of the stuff that we can see? You know, like you're on a project team and in a company. You work for 18 months and something changes in the market. The CEO comes in, shuts that innovation team down, and splits the team up. Three or four other teams get spun up from that, and you're on to something else. You know, 9 out of 10 entrepreneurs in the United States fail. And so when we think about all the things that we've set our society up for, is to manage the changes, mm-hmm. but not the transitions that we all go through. And I think those transitions are so incredibly important. I would go so far as to say I think maybe our biggest innovation challenge in the United States right now is unprocessed grief. We have, you know, our system set up for these rapid cycles of innovate and fail. We even valorize failure as something you're supposed to be proud of and wear. And while that there may be a kernel of truth in there, it's got to be more than the story around it. It's got to be the reality of it, right? And so as our systems change, and we're in this massive transition right now, we, you know, arguably, I'd say we're in the middle of the largest behavioral change in the U.S. in the last 50 years for sure, maybe the last 100. And at this moment, on top of that, we're coming out of pandemics, racial justice reckonings, and on top of that, we are going through extreme environmental transformations, extreme cultural transformations, extreme technological transformations. And those are all, any one of those things in a generation would be a lot.
Yeah.
And we are going through them all at the same time. So it requires a radical act of courageous imagination to think who we are, how do we stay even and get even more human during this process and emerge on the other side of it. As we do that, we have to realize too that human behavior is a wild and woolly thing. You know, our brain has 188 cognitive biases at full operation anytime. And so as we move through transitions and try to figure out who we are in the process and on the other side of that, the beginning is not the first step.
And that's very interesting. The beginning is not the first step. What do you mean by that?
The first step is the ending.
Okay, say more.
We set things up. You know, the first step is, you know, the first step is, you know, in a journey of 1,000 miles. Something has to end for the new thing to come into vision. But we in this country, we like to jump over the ending piece. We don't do death well. We don't do breakups well. We, you know, like think about ghosting on, you know, on social media. We when things end, and things have a natural end to them. It's okay. But we just jump to the beginning. Oh, we'll just start fresh. But if we go through that ending part, the new thing that we think we're on may just be what the Buddhists call, you know, samsara. And so we're destined to just kind of regenerate around this same cycle of death and rebirth until we're able to overcome, you know, attachment and envy and anger and pride and in all those things. And we don't do emotion well in this country. All of our emotions are, seem to me, at least, to be outwardly cast toward others. But the internal work of our own personal emotions, so important. It's so important.
Where does this unprocessed grief come from?
I think it comes from these changes. These many, many changes on top of another. When, I mean, just in its most simplistic terms, when you move from high school, senior in high school, to being a college student, are you the same person?
I wasn't.
I don't think anybody is, because our context, our self-identity, who we see ourselves as, has so radically changed because we have changed the context around it, right? And so all of these transitions that I mentioned are context changes. And as we go through those changes, if we don't manage and lean into and understand the emotional toll that's taking on us to make those kinds of transitions, you go from being married to divorced, high schooler to college student. We go through transitions all the time, right? But if we don't manage and grow through them, we will repeat the mistakes always. All of our sacred traditions tell us this is true, right? And so what does it mean to be able to kind of manage those? Well, there's something in the brain called neurodynamic. It's called the neurodynamic process. So our brain, all those cognitive biases I mentioned, our brains are efficient above all other things. And what our brains do is want to stay efficient, which means that if somebody talks about innovation, your brain goes, oh, that sounds interesting, good, something new coming in. Oh, wait a minute, I'm going to have to change something for that new thing to come in. I don't know if I like that or not, right? And so we focus, I think, far too much on creativity is beneficial, innovation is beneficial. Those are just aspects of human behavior or things that humans are engaged in doing together. They're neither benevolent or malevolent. That's another conversation. But creativity, innovation, are driven by something new coming into play, something novel, something valuable. So when that happens, our brains will say, well, what am I going to have to let go of for that new thing to come in? And so sometimes our brains even start engaging in anticipatory loss before the losses even happen.
I do it all the time.
We all do. Our brains do this just like we don't have to think about breathing. Our brains are doing this, right? And so whenever we envision that we are losing something, we dig our heels in. And then that innovation team in the company I talked about gets turned, and you know, it has to do it again every 6 months. They're getting into a new cycle. Entrepreneurs keep trying to get the magic idea that's gonna work. We see it in our friend groups, right? We keep trying to make a new friend or date a new person because the other ones that we were working with or friends with or dating weren't working out. So if we just find the new person, that's going to fix everything, right? So if we don't manage through our emotions during these changes, this neurodynamic process of the brain interpreting loss kicks into play, which then causes something called allostatic load in the body. Allostatic load is responsible for inflammation. So when you maybe have heard of epigenetics, you know, historical trauma memory in the body. So that is, you know, inflammation is behind so many of our contemporary diseases, you know, heart disease, different form, some forms of cancer. And so this idea around loss and grief and being able to process it is important. But if you look at what's happening here in the United States, we so conflate our personal and professional identities that we sometimes don't know where one ends and the other one begins. And so we accidentally start seeking spiritual well-being related to professional success. We've seen it in the data. Like if you look at the last 50 years, as organized religion has declined, there has been an exact increase in people identifying as spiritual but not religious. As organized religion has declined, we've seen an increase in purpose-driven marketing in companies. We've seen an increase in well-being programs in companies. We've seen an increase in all the things that look like holistic well-being, but trying to be assigned to the workplace.
Little fragmented cults also.
Absolutely, absolutely. Columbia researchers have shown that about a third of our spiritual well-being is actually encoded into our DNA. I'm not talking about religiosity here. I'm talking about just our spiritual, that we're a part of something greater than
even
us
if
as
it's
individuals.
A poetry group.
Even if it's, especially if it's a poetry group, it's the immensity of poetry is probably the most precise and only language that's big enough to hold the human experience. There's a fabulous poet, used to be a biologist in the Galapagos. His name's David White. And David, he was a good friend of John O'Donohue's. And David was doing all of these biological, scientific, discovery projects for 10, 12 years in the Galapagos. And he kept getting bothered by the immensity of what he was experiencing in the wild, underwater, with sharks and turtles, all the way up to what he was. The scientific language that he had in that context was not big enough, nor was it accurate enough to describe what he was experiencing. And so he came home to poetry. He left science to come back to poetry because he needed language that was big enough.
He needs the bridge of the metaphor.
Yes.
You're a speaker to companies. Speak about that. Tell us more.
I'm a culture futurist, and that doesn't mean I predict the future. What I do is multi-dimensional pattern recognition, which is a fancy way of saying I try to locate the infinite in the present. Every kind of harkens back to that memory creativity conversation thing I mentioned earlier, that within everything that we think of in any given moment, there's always our ancestral past that has framed that for us in some ways. There's always this anticipatory aspect of wonder. Wonder's, wonder may be, in some ways, I think the thing that makes us even most uniquely human, because wonder, it's an epistemic emotion, which means that it's the discovery emotion. It makes us want to not only look over the frontier, but what's that about over the frontier? I'm curious. I want to know. So it drives you to doing that. And so that is kind of a notion of like that future history, like what's going on out there. So wonder is kind of this amazing bridge that brings the past and the future all into the current moment of the present. Wonder is also what leads to and opens the door for something called that it allows us to, our brains to open up, stay open to new experiences, but not only stay open, but to be able to kind of take in new information that we're learning and make space for it. It's called cognitive allocation. It helps us to make space for these new ideas in a way that we don't feel like we have to defend against them, right? And so being able to wonder actually leads to another set of emotions called transcendent emotions, which is love and compassion and gratitude. And so the things that companies bring me in for is to help them understand how these things that we typically don't like to talk about in hyper-efficient, productivity-driven corporate business environments.
Meeting to meeting to meeting.
Meeting to meeting to meeting. How can businesses and companies begin to not only think about those things, but incorporate them into how they think about innovation, growth, well-being of the workplace. And what's interesting around this moment that we're in right now is the World Economic Forum, the top five job skills of the future, according to the World Economic Forum, which is not known for being a warm and fuzzy organization. Top five are analytical thinking and creative thinking are one and two. Those are sister skill sets that come out of intelligence research. Three, four, and five are self-awareness, resilience, and curiosity.
Well, most of them are kind of innate things that you cultivate and nobody teaches you in school.
Definitely not on most agendas in most schools, which is why I usually get brought in by these companies, because they know they need them. But how do you actually introduce them into a company that's more than just me teaching you how, you know, some tricks for being more creative individually, for being more self-aware individually? That's great, but companies don't get things done as individuals. They get things done as teams. And so most of the cognitive neuroscience that we know around all of these top skills focuses on individual brains. But then when you think about how things actually work, how enterprises work, how new value gets created, and you had a corporate background, it happens in teams. And so you got to address the team level construct. And so beyond just the individual skill sets themselves, how do you get those skill sets to function in a group of 10 or 10,000? And that's where I get brought in to help companies figure that part out.
What is one thing you tell them that the listeners of Accents can hear that can be of service to them?
For listeners of Accents, here's what I can tell you. Has been the case almost in every single corporate retreat, boardroom, convention I've ever keynoted or facilitated. Always at a break period while I'm getting a coffee or just taking a walk or just hanging out, there'll be one of the leaders of the company that will come to me informally in those break periods as I'm getting my coffee, and they will lean over and I hear them say the same thing. You know, I used to be a poet. You know, I used to play music. You know, I do art sometimes. But they whisper it.
Like they're ashamed of it.
Yes, very much. Wow. So that's a reinforcement to my own understanding that there is a culture that has somehow conflated, if you are a creative person, you are not a leader in business. We talk about creativity, we got all the language to talk about creativity, but that action of how they talk about how they lean over and whisper it.
Leave it at the door.
Yeah. It's one thing to have it on the company's mission statement. It's one thing to have it in the PR and marketing language. But that one small action of privately leaning over, you know, I used to, or I still, it's a secret. So somehow we have conflated being creative or being productive as if they're not conflated.
They're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, we have said they're mutually exclusive, when that's the furthest thing from the truth. I've got some friends who have looked at the history of creativity. And it was really, creativity as we know it today is not that old of a conversation, really. In the scientific fields, maybe 50 to 70 years at best. And really where the historians and linguists look at is there was this kind of period that as we went from kind of Enlightenment-ish time into Romanticism is where creativity was first kind of born into the zeitgeist as we kind of know it today. Because before then, creativity was omnipotent God action, created Earth, you know. And so we didn't talk about human creativity in the same way we talk about it today up until about 200-ish years ago, when the Enlightenment gave way to Romanticism, and that's where our modern notions of creativity first got born. But even then, when that first happened, Enlightenment was logic, right? And then Romanticism, we came in more into the emotion piece of it. That's where and so creativity, this is where we had our artists and our poets and so forth. So there was a story. A story got told in our popular culture that said, oh, these romantics are not to be trusted. These artists, they cut off their ears. They're not to be trusted. They're bohemian. They're not to be trusted.
They drink too much.
They drink too much. They think radical thoughts. That's not something, if you're a leader in a command and control hierarchy, you don't like to hear any of that, right? You like people to step in line and to march straight forward.
And we talk about left brain or right brain, like we cannot use both at the same time.
Yeah, the whole left brain, right brain, we got to let go of that. Such a myth. That is such a myth. I understand where it comes from in the science, but we are always using our whole brains, and like even contemporary neuroscience has really kind of obliterated that myth. We also say that, to your point too, though, there's a lot of myths that we around creativity that we should let go of. Like kids are more creative than adults. That is just not true. Kids don't have the social controls that they put on themselves like adults do, so they're more open. They come up with things, and importantly, when you're 4 years old, everything's new to you. So you don't know that a bottle and an avocado are not supposed to be put together all the time. So you kind of combine everything that you're seeing, because everything is novel. Every combination of things is novel. Every question is novel. But in creativity, novel and useful are the kind of the two components of it. And usefulness can be a social control question. And so,
it's a prejudgment also.
Yeah, it's very much of a prejudgment. Yeah. And so a little glass of, people say, a little glass of wine, I can write my poetry easier. When we have things that let go of those social controls, things begin to flow a little bit more easily. But that social control is a big, big, big piece of why creativity has a bad rap.
Well, thank you for saying all this, because I was the creative, the poet, the writer who went into corporate world and stopped the creative work, so to say. And I worked in corporate America until that poetry came back to me, in which case I said, well, I have to make a choice. And I did, and I chose to leave my job behind and to focus on the poetry. So I didn't think I could have both. Except that I have my own publishing business where I think that I do.
That's exactly what I was thinking as you were saying that. Yes.
So I was finally able to combine the two in my own scale and in my own way in which I can handle both.
There's a wonderful researcher. Her name is Margaret Bowden. She's at the University of Sussex. Dr. Bowden is, I'm guessing, probably in her 70s now. But she has been at the forefront of the global research community's 50 years of investigating where does human creativity end and machine learning begin, which is a really interesting position for a woman to be in, because that's such a heavily dominated field. And Dr. Bowden, throughout the years, just keeps standing toe-to-toe with a lot of the men who come up against her, and not only holds her own, but runs circles around a lot of them. So she's really framed a lot of how we think about creativity, especially in today's generative AI moment. And Dr. Bowden places creativity really in three buckets. She says there's exploratory creativity. That is exploratory creativity is the exploration of a space. So like an academic discipline, like neurology, is a space. And you have, it's defined and has a gatekeeper. So the novel idea that you come up with in that space, whether or not it has value, is determined by the gatekeeper who has been set, a journal editor or something like that, who's been...
Or the self, even.
Or the self, even, right? And so a lot can happen in that space. And I've heard Dr. Bowden say over 80% of all the innovation that we've known in the last 100 years has taken place in that exploratory creativity space. But then there's the second type of creativity beyond exploratory. She calls combinatory, and you're talking about the publishing is what made me remember it. So in combinatory creativity, it's where you take an idea from one sphere of your life, an idea from another sphere of your life, and you put them together. You've achieved novelty, one of the first conditions of creativity. But is it useful? Where does that come from? Who determines that?
And to whom?
And to whom, especially with the pace of change in culture these days. Well, what happens is because we have built all of our systems of the last 7,500 years in that exploratory creativity column, those are institutions, those are universities, those are our corporations. When an idea comes, a combinational idea comes along that looks like it has some real, you know, juice behind it, like it could really go somewhere, what happens is the gatekeepers in that first area want to pull that combinational idea over. They want to put rules around it. They want to say this type is valuable, and that combination. Arts and health would be an example of that. And while I get that, what I think we accidentally do is when a combinational idea comes along, we try to institutionalize it way too early.
Is that attempt to slow it down?
Yeah.
Because the institutions just, you know, two snails crawl slower than one.
That's right. It's very much an attempt to slow it down and probably shore up some inadequate revenue models that have been outmoded in that first kind of institutional column. But then,
raise some money, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, look, no money, no mission, as they say in the U.S. these days. But then there's, so exploratory, combinational. Then she says there's transformational creativity. And transformational creativity is rare, but when it happens, it changes everything. And she defines transformational creativity is this way. Is that an idea, a group of people come along with something that so foundationally shifts how novelty and value were even understood in those first two areas that those conversations just don't even make sense anymore in the same way. An example that's easy for us all to understand around that is our iPhone. So the microprocessor, right, it comes along, that's the novel idea. Part of the way we understood its value was through economic production. So that microprocessor becomes a computer, it becomes a television, it becomes a GPS system, all these calculator, all of these three-dimensional objects that had independent economic value because of part of the commerce. Novel idea, economic value. But then the iPhone comes along. Almost overnight, those three-dimensional products disappear and become lines of code in one platform. Something that's been introduced that has so foundationally shifted how novelty and value were understood that they don't even make sense anymore.
Well, the MBA books call it disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, economists talk about transformational things in economics, and most economists will tell you that anything that shifts the status quo should be the default position if economic growth is your goal. And what's been interesting about transformational ideas too, though, is it's not just about the creativity conversation around transformation, novel, and value. What's interesting, when the iPhone came along, it did something else that sociologists talk about. It changed human behavior.
Yeah, it's true.
And so when we think about, like, you know, the difference between we were too hard on Gen Z. I mean, Gen Z, because we make a lot of pronouncements on them that I think are unfair. So if we think about innovation as being, and this is the way I define it, my work, innovation, real transformational innovation, is anything that changes human conception of time and distance. The wheel was an innovation changing human conception of time and distance. The internet changed human conception of time and distance. So when time and distance change our brains, those little hyper-efficient sacks of meat they are in our heads, they will start reorganizing how we behave based on these new conceptions of time and distance. And so Gen Z, as the first generation of digital natives, they can, from their bedroom, they can, in 3 minutes, they've grown up being able to find out about a spice in Morocco, a punk band in a garage in Philadelphia, or a specific, you know, a part of the Appalachian Trail a friend told them about, all in 3 minutes and never have to go anywhere. Time and distance change for them. And so when time and distance change, human behavior change. And I think a lot of the things that we're dealing with now, going back to that identity piece that we talked about, is you go back even just 150 years, a grandmother and her great-great-great-granddaughter would probably be expected to live more or less the same life. But the pace of technology is so accelerated today that a mother and her daughter will absolutely live radically different lives because of the pace of technology alone. And our brains haven't changed in size in 50,000 plus years, but the amount of data that we are being asked to take in on any given day has exponentially increased in just a few years. You know, and so that's an identity transition.
Well, I mean, you read a lot about dissociation and just people can't take it.
That's right. And so going back to, you know, chronic disappointment and processed grief, mm-hmm. something has been gained through technology, but something's also been lost. But we've not done anything with that loss. And so our brains are just, you know, doing their neurodynamic thing that they do. So how do we do that? How do we address this as a nation? I think it's got to be through poetry. Poetry in my world is not just words on a page. Poetry happens, you know, when you see kind of sunlight reflected in fractals through a drop of dew falling off the edge of a leaf. That's poetry. When you hear a baby cry, that's poetry. When you see those James Webb Space Telescope images come through, that's poetry. Poetry is unlike any other thing in human history, sturdy enough to hold whatever it's asked to hold. I don't know any other part of our human experience that we can say the same thing about.
Now it's a good time for me to ask you about your writing.
I've been doing a lot more research writing recently than I have poetry. However, I am working. I'm working on finishing up two books and beginning to work on a third. I'm working on a business book about leadership called Wondervation. It's kind of signaling into some of the things I talked about earlier.
That sounds fabulous.
Thank you. I'm very, very excited about it. I think the whole creative economy is actually in a transition to what I call the wonder economy, where these parallel investments in future of work, technology, what are the parallel investments in dreaming, leading, of unlocking human creative potential? What has to happen for those two things to balance each other out in a really positive way? Because I'm okay with AI. I'm optimistic about it. The other book I'm working on is a book of poetry that I have been, contains little breadcrumbs from really the last 20 years. And it's called Before We Had Words to Name Flowers. In 2022, my mother was diagnosed with aggressive form of terminal brain cancer the same month that my grandmother died. The next month, my childhood best friend fell off of a ladder in her kitchen and died. The following month, my most beloved work colleague in Denver terminated her own life. And then the following month after that, my mother died from her brain cancer. And so...
I'm so sorry. Sounds like an awful, very, very, very difficult year.
I've emerged a stronger version of a man than I actually probably ever gave myself credit for on the other side of it. But I also had been, looking back, had been preparing for something that I didn't know was going to happen leading up to that point. And it was the words of John O'Donohue. I took a lot of hikes listening to John O'Donohue's words. And the thing that I love about O'Donohue is his poetry and his writing is not precious. It's brutal and lovely about in its exploration of precious things. Actually, one of the poems that I'm working on, you helped me edit it years ago. And I've thought about has nothing to do with the book I'm writing, but I thought about one of your poems many, many times over, especially over the last few years, in the last couple of years, actually, as I was going through the grief and loss. And do you remember the poem, There Are Things I Want to Write Home About, that you wrote?
Yes, and the interesting thing is I've never used it anywhere, but continue.
That poem has been with me like a old friend over the last few years. Because even the title alone is so, so rich. You don't know. It holds anticipation. It holds melancholy. It holds optimism. It holds pain. But it holds them all lightly.
Hold secrets too.
Yes. 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 Sometimes I think the worst secrets out there are the ones we keep from ourselves.
That's true. That's true. But I mean, I have made very concerted effort to keep as few secrets as possible, and none within my family and my marriage, certainly.
Yeah.
So to me, that is something that I strive for.
The secret that we see when we look in the mirror is the one I was talking about keeping from ourselves. And it's been a very incredible journey to be able to see yourself, to see myself clearly. Over the last 20, 30 years. And
is it seeing or accepting? Are they?
I think it's seeing, because the accepting piece, if you see yourself clearly, acceptance is held within that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still paint?
I do. I do. I painted, especially during COVID, my husband and I painted a lot. We actually turned our dining room table into, just always had watercolors and inks and paper on there. And I did an entire series during COVID that I'm quite proud of. And then third book, actually, Kentucky Humanities Magazine published an early version of this a few years ago. It's a children's book. It's called Miss Myrtle and the Razzle Dazzle Bell Bang Bluegrass Band. I've taken that original poem and I've done something very surprising with it. And I'm pulling that original work forward, and I'm going to be publishing it sometime in the next couple of years or so.
You said something that took me by surprise. I probably should have known that, but I didn't. You live in Colorado?
Yeah, I've been, been in Colorado 3 years. I live in Denver.
What took you to Colorado?
I got recruited out there to take over as head of innovation for the University of Colorado and the Denver College of Arts and Media, and expanded into a national project called Creativity America, which is a 10-year national initiative to essentially increase the creativity of American enterprise by 25% in a decade. And so it's cognitive neuroscience scientists, it's industrial organizational behavioral psychologists, contemplatives, humanities researchers, artists, and futurists.
Sounds like all the top employable skills into one person right there.
You know, if you, my grandmother told me one time, she said, "Honey, life is like riding a bicycle. If you just keep pedaling, the scenery is going to change and may change to something you like more than maybe what you're seeing. But if you stop pedaling, there's not but one option, that's to fall over into the ditch, and the scenery is not ever going to change." And so I like to think that maybe, you know, 50 years in, that my skills maybe fit the moment at hand better than they ever have.
So do you remember, it was 2009, you were an artist in New York City about to have a big solo exhibition, and three other poets came from Kentucky to spend some time with you and to have a reading at
Bowery.
At the Bowery Club, yes. That is something that I'll always remember, that reading of ours. But what's my question? My question is, and I think that we were children. I mean, like 15
sure.
years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're all in our 30s. We were children.
Yes.
What would you want to say to that, to Tio from 2009, who is about to read his heart out at the Bowery Club about the future or anything else?
Your intuition is correct.
We can't be on accents without reading a poem, right?
Yes. So this is very much inspired by and an homage to John O'Donohue and David White, who really gave me space during this period to be able to enter in wilderness skills. You don't wait for revelation when you pass the frontier. Desire is truth here. The fiery stardust inside you, it's pulled you a step beyond. Into a beyond place where you use up everything in service to finding that last speck of joy. Beyond the old stories, you overround yourself for protection and fascination. A veneer of curiosity manufactured for others, those who you believe not to be trustworthy in their own estimations. Fiery stardust has pulled you an uncomfortable step beyond those old stories. You don't wait for revelation here. when you pass the frontier, wilderness skills will be needed. Wilderness skills like those you learned when you first fell in love. That raw meat moment where you first heard the calling of your original name. Away from the figuration of settled houses and etiquette protocols. Crossing a frontier is a high desert maneuver. It's a fierce decision made in extreme honesty of each new breath. Wilderness skills are not learned as professions. They are acquired through intention and vocation, radical convergent release of all those heavy things you picked up and carried along your way to this frontier. Vocation and navigation, it seems, go hand in glove. Pavement to gravel, gravel to earth, earth to desire, desire. The etymology of that word means to hold a star. Pull a step beyond the frontier. Your old stories don't seem big enough. Pull a step beyond the frontier. You feel the aligning of crucible bones. It's a homecoming. Stories you used to shape your presence back in those old settled houses are not going to survive here. Frontiers find their shape among interior landscapes, made real in honest mirrors. In this reflection, though, is a realization. You don't really know language at all, at least language capable enough of navigating the well-worn and mapped-out reflection staring back at you, a reflection that makes no sense when you've been pulled beyond the frontier. And this loss of language hits you hard. If you don't have language here, here in your reflected face, the reflection you thought you knew so well back in those old settled houses, then you wonder, does language even exist at all? What is the love language of wilderness? As you begin flicking off old, shallow reflections and intuition grows inside you, deepness, it's dependable. Moving past the frontier requires reaching further in, inside to horizons you arrived at long ago but were too busy performing old shallow stories in settled houses to notice. In wilderness, deepness is dependable. Deepness is dependable. I learned I was going to die in my early skin when I first learned to love. Learning to be loved in return would take longer. Learning to be loved in return is a wilderness skill. And in that early skin, warmth was a death quilt, an exquisite corpse pieced together with science and business and art, laid across the mall of a nation and stitched together with memories of those who dared to cross frontiers, those who learned in early skin that love is a wilderness skill. Sometimes, he said, the blessing of things skips past human curtains that are hanging in old settled houses. Blessings require making fierce decisions to walk lightly through deep woods. A blessing requires you to be equal to it. Survivors of plagues know this. Survivors of plagues feel guilty for that knowledge sometimes. In the deep woods, you must give away things. Give away things so you become large enough, light enough to make fierce decisions every day where you feel your instinctual courage, courageous imagination connecting head, heart, and hands. Vision is a vocation. In the wilderness, far-off places are not silent. They just cannot be heard through yesterday's eyes. Frontier vision requires more from you. More than is required in those old settled houses. To find the ground you are meant to stand on, you don't wait for revelation when you pass the frontier. You make fierce decisions to let go of those small names you once carried around room to room in old settled houses. They will only weigh you down here. Fiery stardust has pulled you that uncomfortable step beyond. When you pass the frontier, forging into the wilderness of an open life, it is wonder calling you home. And should you choose to answer, should you choose to snatch back your stardust from the cold zone of those ransom things, your wilderness skills are needed.
What a journey this poem is. What a journey a conversation with you is. Thank you so much, Theo,
you.
For coming on Accents, and please keep in touch.
I absolutely will. So good to see your face across the table from mine.
I love you.
I love you too.